I'll be talking about Gilgamesh. The story of Gilgamesh comes to us from the earliest of civilizations, that of the Sumerians, who were also the inventors of writing. The earliest cuneiform inscriptions concerning Gilgamesh are from a time only a little after the invention of writing itself. And it is interesting to note that Gilgamesh of Uruk was a priest of Inanna, for it was the priests of Inanna in Uruk that are credited with the invention. Gilgamesh himself is believed to have lived around 2800 BC. His name is found in the list of the ancient kings, in a dynasty who descended from the sky. After his death, he was divinized, and statues of him abound in the ancient remains of Mesopotamia. It is most likely that the writing of the earliest Gilgamesh stories followed a period of transmission through oral poetry. And it is most remarkable that this earliest of literary traditions was still alive in the Near East until recent times. For Gurdjieff tells in his autobiography that his father could recite the Epic of Gilgamesh, and this was before the cuneiform inscriptions were deciphered. When the Sumerians were conquered by the Akkadians, Semitic invaders who created the first old empire, the Gilgamesh poem was translated. And it was also translated later to the language of the Assyrian conquerors and to that of the Hittites. It is clear that the deeds of Gilgamesh were well known in ancient times. Through all those people and even the Mycenaeans, it may be assumed that it was well known to the Aramean invaders too, the Chaldeans who established themselves in Babylonia and out of which migrated, according to Genesis, Abraham with his people. Just as the Odyssey, written in the 8th century BC, constitutes an elaboration and a piecing together of poetic creations of earlier centuries, anything between Homer's time and that of the war in Troy in the 13th century BC, the tale of Gilgamesh that we know constitutes the Babylonian written crystallization of a much earlier Sumerian tale that was probably as old in the days of the Bronze Age pre-Homeric bards as Homer is old to us. Though 5 Sumerian poems have Gilgamesh as their hero, what today is usually called the Gilgamesh Epic is a later composite creation, which brings together the material in 2 of them, as well as an early story of the deluge. As Federico Lara writes in the introduction to his Spanish translation of the Babylonian text, the poem was a creation of the Sumerian culture that has passed through the wise and eclectic screen of Semitic sensibility. And this first great work of universal literature would take 2 millennia before it found its definitive structure. It may be approximately said that Gilgamesh is the first tale of the hero that we know. I say approximately since other works, such as Inanna's Descent into Hell, can also be understood as expressions of the timeless journey of the soul. The story of Gilgamesh, however, is a more complete expression of the soul's journey than others, and also is characteristically the tale about a human hero rather than a god, and a literary work rather than a myth as generally understood. It stands at the beginning of literature proper as the oldest account of self-divinization. The Epic of Gilgamesh begins with an implicit prologue that constitutes the first column of the first of 12 tablets. The essence of this prologue is condensed in its opening statement. The one who saw the abyss, I will make the land know. Of him who knew all, let me tell the whole story. The Lord of Wisdom, he who knew everything, Gilgamesh, who saw secret things, opened the place hidden and carried back word of the time before the flood. He traveled the road, exhausted, in pain, and cut his works into a stone tablet. Of course, we should take to whom all things are known, or to whom all things were known, to contain a symbolic reference to the inner experiential knowledge of one who has completed the soul's journey, the wisdom of one who has lived through the laborious process of transformation. As in other tales of a hero, it is suggested by the poem that Gilgamesh was fated to succeed in the quest of turning from an ordinary human into an awakened and fully matured member of the species, that is, one of superhuman stature. The Babylonian epic tells us that Gilgamesh was well endowed. When the gods created Gilgamesh, they gave him a perfect body. Shamash, the glorious sun, endowed him with beauty. Adad, the god of the storm, endowed him with courage. Though the poem begins with praise of Gilgamesh's final achievement and condition, it soon turns to the time when he was only an unripe hero, at the beginning of his life's journey. We're told he was powerful as a king, yet one who comes across to us as power-driven. His people complained to the gods. Though there is some doubt as to the exact nature of that about which they complained, the picture we form is certainly that of a powerful but abusive king. In the raising of his weapon, there was no equal. And yet, he does not allow the son to go to his father. Day and night he oppresses the weak. Gilgamesh, who is shepherd, strong, shining, Gilgamesh does not let the young woman go to her mother, the girl to the warrior, the bride to the young groom. Uruk of the sheepfold is the designation of the city in the late Babylonian text in reference to the identification of the king priest with a shepherd. It is not strange, however, that in view of the abuses of Gilgamesh, the people ask, is this the shepherd of Uruk, of the sheepfold? Apparently he exercises too much power in taking the young men into war and exaggerates his kingly rights over the women. Since in the story of Gilgamesh, he appears to have been one of the first military conquerors who gave Uruk a triumph over the rival city of Kish, it is likely that his abuses were those of the exaggerated patriarchal reaction that assured the victory of the new socio-political system over the earlier matriarchal times in the Middle East. After hearing the lamentation of the people of Uruk, the gods of the above in turn called on Aruru, the goddess of creation. When Anu, the sky god, heard their lamentation, he called to Aruru, the mother, great lady, "You, Aruru, who created humanity, create now a second image of Gilgamesh. May the image be equal to the time of his heart. Let them square off one against the other, that Uruk may have peace." The following lines of the poem are reminiscent of the creation of Adam in Genesis. She conceived an image in her mind, and it was a stuff of Anu, of the firmament. The biblical parallel continues. She dipped her hands in water and pinched off clay. She let it fall in the wilderness, and noble Enkidu was created. His hair is long, like a woman's, and Gilgamesh is to love him like a woman. Ninsun, Gilgamesh's mother, will tell him that he will find a companion whom he could call Hug Like a Wife. If Gilgamesh is a hero that sets out the egoic self that embarks on the path that will entail his own undoing, what is this creation of a double for Gilgamesh? If Gilgamesh is the king within the mind, the controlling self, the little and yet grandiose I, who is this innocent man who eats grass in the hills with the gazelles? We are told of him that he was like an immortal from heaven. If we approach the symbolic system of the myth as we would approach a dream, we can say that both Gilgamesh and Enkidu are parts of the individual, and that the hero who starts out as a single monolithic mind now has become the field of two subselves in struggle, a controlling and a natural, spontaneous animal self. While Gilgamesh may be seen as an extreme embodiment of the patriarchal mind, it is the mother qualities that are most apparent in Enkidu. So we may say Gilgamesh's search is on the way to becoming more balanced. The story proceeds to tell us how, when Enkidu came to the water holes with the wild animals, he was seen by a stalker who was greatly terrified, and who next lamented to his father concerning this wild giant who helped the animals to undo his traps. The old man advised the stalker he should obtain from Gilgamesh a temple harlot to come and seduce and civilize Enkidu. Of course, the word civilize is not used. We could also say hominize, for now Enkidu will be transformed from a human animal into the companion of Gilgamesh through the intervention of a woman. The stalker's father asserts that once he has lain with her, the animals will reject him, which reflects a good knowledge in antiquity of something that scientists have recently observed in laboratory conditions. A lamb that has been touched by human hands is rejected by the herd, for instance. At the level of inner meaning, we may say this transformation of Enkidu, a transformation of animality or natural instinct, is a process through which the harlot entices Enkidu with her presence, interests him coming to the great city, finally brings him to Gilgamesh, might be viewed as a birth of a new life within the psyche. A new birth that will undergo and refinement, but not to the point of cancelling that antagonism towards Gilgamesh's attitude that the gods desired as a remedy to the country's predicament. Gilgamesh, stronger even than Enkidu, and favored by Shamash and Anu of the heavens, is one in whom dominance has become a perversion. Yet, after meeting Enkidu, his energy will find a less destructive course. I have come to change the old order, for I am the strongest here, Enkidu seems to say to the harlot when, after hearing of Gilgamesh's abuses, he sets out to meet him. A marriage is about to take place when Enkidu comes to meet Gilgamesh, and it seems that Gilgamesh is coming to claim his royal rights before the husband. The bride waited for the bridegroom, but in the night Gilgamesh got up and came to the house. Then Enkidu stepped out, he stood in the street and blocked the way. A power struggle takes place, where both the doorposts and walls shook. They snorted like bulls locked together. Gilgamesh was stronger. Enkidu surrendered, and this was the beginning of their friendship. This friendship will progress into brotherhood when Gilgamesh takes his friend to his mother Ninsun and adopts him as her own son, blesses him, and charges him with the protection of Gilgamesh. We may say thus far, we have an allegory of a healing integration within the psyche. I have proposed that we view the creation of Enkidu as an inner birth that occurs at the beginning of the quest. The way in which this inner birth is portrayed, however, seems so different from that second birth acknowledged by the Hindu and Christian traditions that I need to pause to assert my conviction that they refer to the same event in the process of human unfoldment. The parallel will seem more complete later, through the fact that just as the inner Christ is not only born but dies, so too it is with Enkidu, before the time of Gilgamesh's resurrection. We may say that the birth of the savage was, in the Gilgamesh story, the precondition for the calling. For it is immediately following the encounter between Gilgamesh and Enkidu that Gilgamesh feels the desire to set out on an adventure. It will turn out to be the first of several adventures, yet in a sense it is the adventure, for it is the one that he originally seeks, and we imagine that it is one from which he thinks that he will return. The gods were right in responding to the distress of the people with the creation of a match for Gilgamesh, and now his overwhelming and overpowering energy is about to fall upon them in its restlessness. The pugnacity of Gilgamesh from now on have something superhuman as a target. Since he has seen that whoever is tallest among men cannot reach the heavens, and the greatest cannot encompass the earth, he wants now to enter what the text calls, rather enigmatically, the country of the living. It is clear that the country of the living is not meant to be for humans. For when he implores the help of the sun, glorious Shamash answers, Gilgamesh, you are strong. But what is the country of the living to you? The words of Gilgamesh leave no doubt that his longing is the same as every human that sets out on life's inner adventure. He will not be contained by the city. He wants something more. We may say that he dimly seeks something eternal, for he had a dream that Enkidu interpreted for him to mean that he should understand that his destiny is kingship and not everlasting life. In his wakeful life, however, the longing of Gilgamesh is for something less than eternity. He explains to his companion, I have not established my name on brick, as my destiny decreed. Therefore, I will go to the country where the cedar is felled. I will set up my name in the place where the name of famous men are written, and where no man's name is written, I will raise a monument to the gods. His wish to conquer Humbaba, the keeper of the cedar forest, is not all that different from the will to fight Enkidu, and the kind of greatness that, according to history, immortalized him as a great conqueror in the days of the first dynasties. It is remarkable that this very early telling of the hero's tale is so profoundly psychological in the caricature it presents before us of a childish quality of Gilgamesh's heroic seeking. Chögyam Trungpa would have spoken of this as spiritual materialism. The narcissistic element in his search for something beyond the ordinary reminds us of a much later caricature, that which Cervantes gave us of Don Quixote. For Don Quixote, craziness is precisely this juxtaposition of the sublime ideal and the ridiculous of his thirst for recognition. The poem tells us that on hearing Gilgamesh's intention, Enkidu's heart was sick. He answered Gilgamesh, The cry of sorrow sticks in my throat. Why must you set your heart on this enterprise? Gilgamesh also resembles Don Quixote in his rationalization. Because of the evil that is in the land, he will go to the forest and destroy the evil. For in the forest lives Humbaba, whose name is Dangerous, the prodigious giant. It seems that Gilgamesh needs to make Humbaba bad as to make himself good, just as Don Quixote, seeing giants instead of windmills, serve his construction of a heroic image for himself through the struggle against evil. Yet viewing Humbaba as evil is most questionable. We're told that Anu appointed him keeper of the cedar forest, and we may see in him the figure of the master of animals that is still alive in the minds of shamanistic cultures. Humbaba, whom we're told has the mouth of a dragon, comes to us as a force of nature, or the embodiment of nature itself, that nature of which Enkidu was fully a part before being tamed. Perhaps with a logic similar to that of dreams, we're given here a continuation of the first fight of Gilgamesh against Enkidu, the inner struggle between a civilized aspect of the mind and the animal level within it. If so, we shouldn't be surprised that the slaying of Humbaba that will crown this episode brings about the death of Enkidu. If Humbaba is not evil, however, it is unavoidable to feel that Gilgamesh is at fault in slaying him. The situation creates a certain suspense in the reader, who may wonder what will be coming to Gilgamesh in consequence for his action. When we see that complications arise, we feel justified, even though Gilgamesh is not directly punished for his deed. But let us not skip ahead. Before setting out on the Humbaba adventure, Gilgamesh, following Enkidu's advice, seeks the protection of the sun god. Whoever is tallest among men cannot reach the heavens, Gilgamesh explains. The greatest cannot encompass the earth. Therefore, I would enter that country because I have not established my name stamped in brick as my destiny decreed. This he pleads before Shamash. If this enterprise is not to be accomplished, why did you move me, Shamash, with a restless desire to perform it? Shamash was merciful and accepted the sacrifice of his tears. Only because of the allies he gave to Gilgamesh, the eight great winds, Gilgamesh would be able to win. The two giants had craftsmen forge heavy armor and weapons for them. A little interpretation is out of the question. It seems that the poet has wanted to indicate this through the very exaggeration. The swords of the heroes weighed 60 pounds each one, and after setting out, it is only after 20 leagues that they broke their fast. The reference is undoubtedly to the superhuman exaltation of their capacities, and of the individual's capacities in general at this point in the inner journey. It is the mission of Enkidu to go first, to protect Gilgamesh, and to urge him on. Step up to him, do not let him go, climb to the woods, do not be afraid. Humbaba has clothed himself with 7 cloaks, he has put on 1. 6 cloaks are not yet on him, yet after a point the roles reverse. Enkidu shapes his mouth and speaks to Gilgamesh, saying, "Friend, let us not go up into the heart of the forest. Opening the gate, my hand went weak." It is Gilgamesh's turn now to encourage him. "Touch my heart, you will not fear death. Let your heart grow light in battle. Forget death, fear nothing." The beginning of the Humbaba adventure proper is clearly demarcated in the poem. There is a gate that the hero must cross to enter the forest. The corresponding column is rather incomplete in the tablet, yet it appears to address a door as if it were human. It is Enkidu who insists that Humbaba be killed after he has been defeated and after he asks for mercy. This is how the Hittite text paints the scene. Heavenly Shamash, listen to the prayer of Gilgamesh, and against Huwawa mighty winds rise up. 8 winds rose up against him and beat against the eyes of Huwawa, and he was unable to move forward nor was able to move back. Then Huwawa said to Gilgamesh, "Let go, Gilgamesh, you will be my master and I your servant." But Enkidu said to Gilgamesh, "The words Huwawa has spoken, do not hear, do not listen." Hearing Enkidu encourage Gilgamesh, Humbaba said, "Enkidu, you have spoken evil. In envy, for fear of a rival, you have spoken evil words." But Enkidu seems to have been fully convinced by Gilgamesh previously to the effect that Humbaba is evil and fears that he is not to be trusted. He prevails on Gilgamesh. And this aspect of the story seems to suggest that just as his brute force makes the adventure possible, his excessive brutishness ends by making it less than felicitous. When he saw the head of the forest guardian, the god Enlil of the mountain raged at them. "Why did you do this thing? From henceforth, may the fire sit where you sit. May it eat the bread you eat. May it drink where you drink." After 4 millennia, we will find this very situation, though in a different garb, in various romances of chivalry in the Grail cycle. It will be quite clear in them that according to the code of honor of the knights, it is well to be satisfied with triumph when a victim, having accepted defeat, offers satisfaction. Turning from the literal to the inner meaning, we may say that the issue is not of slaying of the inner animal, but of domestication, or more generally of transformation of energies, as in the case of medieval knights that are reproached or punished for lack of charity. It seems that Gilgamesh here has been guilty of not being satisfied with Humbaba's surrender and his offer to serve him. The emotional logic of the story thus leads us to expect some form of retribution. This comes in directly after the battle with the Bull of Heaven, which we may regard as an echo of the battle against Humbaba. Let us now consider the second adventure of the Gilgamesh epic, which begins when our shining hero, glowing from his victory, meets the great goddess whom the Sumerians called Inanna and the Babylonians Ishtar. Given the central position of the Hieros Gamos in the tale of the hero, this might well be called the tale of the hero and the goddess, yet Gilgamesh is not ready for a union that he well knows is not only of love, but of death. For Inanna, goddess of love and war, is known precisely for the death that she brings to her lovers, particularly to the first of these, Tammuz, the Babylonian antecedent to Osiris. In this too, we may see the ancient epic as true to life and extremely sophisticated in its implicit humor. Just as it has depicted the unripeness of Gilgamesh when he set out to conquer Humbaba, it now depicts his unripeness as he approaches the second stage of his journey, which will be under the aegis of the Great Mother rather than that of the glorious Shamash. The encounter with Ishtar might well be taken as the crowning episode of the hero's ambition. If Gilgamesh had sought glory, for what greater glory could there be for a mortal than being sought as a husband by the great goddess? To Gilgamesh's beauty, great Ishtar lifted her eyes, says the poem. Come, Gilgamesh, be my lover, give me the taste of your body. Would that you were my husband and I your wife. We might say that with Ishtar, there starts for Gilgamesh a journey within the journey. He's not ready to surrender to the goddess, yet we are left with the impression that his refusal, compounded into an insult, reveals itself as something akin to that movement against destiny that only contributes to the fulfillment of destiny in the old Greek tragedies. If we read the poem in an impressionistic manner, as we read a dream, we indeed see Inanna as a bringer of death to him, and thus a gateway for the journey that Gilgamesh now goes forth into death in search for immortal life. But let us return to the story. When rejected, Inanna appeals to Anu of the firmament, demanding that the gods create a bull of heaven and turn him against our heroes. She threatens to open the gates of hell so the dead will compete with the living, and so that the gods are forced to oblige her and now only ask Inanna whether she has made herself ready for the 7 years of famine that are to follow his creation. Gilgamesh and Enkidu defeat the Bull of Heaven, and this defeat is like a repetition of their titanic battle with Humbaba. Yet in the end, Enkidu's excessive aggression in face of the goddess brings about his own end. After he defiantly throws one of the bull's thighs onto the face of the goddess, she, insulted, demands of the gods the death of one or the other of the companions. I have already intimated that if Enkidu is a literary expression of the birth of a new life within the individual, we may correspondingly see in his death a reference to an internal death, the disappearance from the life of Gilgamesh of his beloved and supportive other. We now come to that part of the story that describes Enkidu's sickness. When Enkidu knew himself a dying man, he first cursed the woman that domesticated him, but then, urged by Shamash, blessed her. Then he dreamed that the heavens groaned and the earth resounded, and the talons of an eagle grabbed him by the hair, overpowering him, and bore him down to the house of darkness, the house of Irkalla, the house where one goes in never to come out again, the road that if one takes it, one never comes back, the house that if one lives there, one never sees light. The fourth column of tablet 7 breaks off with Ereshkigal lifting her head and looking directly at the newcomer. Who has brought this one here? The precise moment of Enkidu's death is not described in what has survived of the poem, which continues in tablet 7 with Gilgamesh's lament. In the interpretation of the story that I'm offering, this lament corresponds to a time of mourning in the individual who has undergone an inner dying process and is analogous to the mourning of Isis for Osiris. The mourning proper ends when Gilgamesh issues a call throughout the land to his artisans to fashion a life-size gold image of his friend with the breast of lapis lazuli. Through this Enkidu that has died instead of Gilgamesh, Gilgamesh not only mourns him deeply, but is afraid for his own fate. Seeing the inevitability of his own death, he now truly embarks on his second journey. This is not contaminated by the pursuit of fame and of glory. Yet we see that it is contaminated by fear and a confusion between the eternal and the everlasting. He decides that he will go to the house of Utnapishtim, the only one to whom the gods have given eternal life, and seek his help. Me, will I not die like Enkidu? Sorrow has come into my belly. I fear death. I roam over the hills. I will seize the road. Quickly I will go to the house of Utnapishtim, offspring of Ubaratutu. Upon embarking in his quest to Utnapishtim, the far away, it is not to the sun god, to Shamash, that Gilgamesh now prays, but to the moon god, Sin. Yet he acts as a solar hero when, axe in hand, he falls upon the lions that block his path, smashing them. Perhaps the best known representation of Gilgamesh is that in which he stands holding one lion in each hand by the tail, in reference to this episode. Perhaps more deadly than the lions are the scorpion men and the scorpion woman whom he finds at the gate that marks the entrance of the night journey proper. That will take him through the darkness inside the mountains, the tops of which reach the vaults of heaven, while below their feet touch the underworld. When the scorpion man called to his woman, saying, "This one who has come to us, his body is the flesh of the gods," the woman retorted, "Two-thirds of him is God, one-third human." An expression which we may read as applicable to every human being, consubstantial with the divine at both ends, so to say, a son or daughter of heaven and earth, continues with both matter and mind. When Gilgamesh tells the scorpion man that he has come on account of Utnapishtim, who stands in the assembly of the gods and has found life, the scorpion man assures Gilgamesh that no mortal man has accomplished this journey, only Shamash. Still, Gilgamesh insists, and he is allowed to go on. Like the Egyptian Osiris, he is to follow the sun's road to its rising through the mountain. And now comes my favorite part of the whole poem. When he had gone one league, the darkness became thick around him, for there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. After 2 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. After 3 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. After 4 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. At the end of 5 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. At the end of 6 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. When he had gone 7 leagues, the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. When he had gone 8 leagues, Gilgamesh gave a great cry, for the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. After 9 leagues, he felt the north wind on his face, but the darkness was thick and there was no light. He could see nothing ahead and nothing behind him. After 10 leagues, the end was near. After 11 leagues, the dawn light appeared. At the end of 12 leagues, the sun streamed out. Next, Gilgamesh finds himself in the Garden of the Gods, that is filled with jeweled-like plants, and significantly covered with vines. The presence of wine in the paradise that Gilgamesh reaches after crossing the mountains may be taken as a symbol of transformation through rebirth, for we know well how wine has carried the significance in both Near Eastern and Greek religion. We may conjecture that this paradise was the end of some early version of the Gilgamesh story, but just as the early stage of Gilgamesh's career has come to be formed of two rather than one adventure, the slaying of Humbaba and the similar adventure of the Bull of Heaven, so in the Babylonian version of the epic we find the second adventure on the hero's path, which occurs under the aegis of the moon and will make him into a priest of Inanna, is constituted of two very similarly impossible journeys, the first through the mountains, the second through the waters of death. At the edge of this Garden of the Sun, Gilgamesh meets the guardian of another gate along his path. Siduri, as she is called, constitutes another embodiment of the Great Mother. She offers him a golden bowl of wine. She is covered with a veil and sees Gilgamesh walking toward her, his face like that of a man who has gone on a long journey. She bars the door on Gilgamesh and interrogates him. Why is your strength wasted, your face sunken? There is sorrow in your belly. Your face is weathered by cold and heat because you roam the wilderness in search of a wind puff. Gilgamesh explains to her that his strength is wasted and that cold and heat have weathered his features because Enkidu, his friend, has died. In fear of death, I roam the wilderness. The case of my friend lies heavy in me. On a remote path, I roam the wilderness. The case of my friend Enkidu lies heavy in me. On a long journey, I wander through the steppe. How can I keep still? How can I be silent? Now, barmaid, which is the way to Utnapishtim? What are his landmarks? Give it to me. Give it signs to me. If it is possible, let me cross the sea. If it is possible, let me traverse the wilderness. She retorts that there never has been a crossing except for Shamash, and even if he were able to cross the sea, what would he do on arriving at the waters of death? Her behavior is paradoxical, for while she tells Gilgamesh that the journey is impossible, she directs him to Ur-Shanabi, the boatman to Utnapishtim. Show him your face. If it is possible, cross with him. If it is not possible, come back. There follows a scene in which Gilgamesh destroys certain stone objects, which apparently made it possible for Ur-Shanabi's boat to cross the waters of death. It seems to convey a situation along the path when the individual in utter despair explodes in impatience and irritation, and yet, mercifully, his self-destructive impetuousness turns out not to be fatal. When Gilgamesh addresses Ur-Shanabi, we find less fear in him than when he explained his situation to the scorpion man and to Siduri. As he tells Ur-Shanabi his predicament, it is pain and love for his friend that stand out rather than fear. Now Ur-Shanabi tells Gilgamesh that his own hands have hindered the crossing when he destroyed those stone things, yet again paradoxically instructs him to take an axe, to go down into the forest, and to cut poles, 120 poles of 60 cubits. It is by heaving these poles that Gilgamesh pushes their boat as they cross the waters of death. When all of them are gone, he strips himself, he holds up his arms for a mast and his covering for a sail. The image evokes a nearly perfect coincidence of a running out of resources and the crossing to the other shore, a synchronization comparable to that of a rocket that has an exact amount of fuel to leap into a different orbit. Gilgamesh at last comes to Utnapishtim, the far away, and explains his dark night of the soul. I said, I will go to Utnapishtim, the remote one, about whom they tell tales. I turned wandering over all the lands. I crossed uncrossable mountains. I traveled all the seas. No real sleep has calmed my face. I have worn myself out of sleeplessness. My flesh is filled with grief. I had not yet arrived at the house of the barmaid when my clothing was used up. I slept in dirt and bitumen. Utnapishtim's reply is incompletely preserved, but it seems to say that when Gilgamesh's divine parents conceived him in the assembly of the gods, he was fated to be mortal, not immortal. From the beginning, there is no permanence. Gilgamesh's reaction on meeting Utnapishtim is that of a surprise at finding one not essentially different from himself. He who has pursued the extraordinary, the super warrior that some identify with the biblical Nimrod, cannot believe that Utnapishtim is not himself heroic. Yet Utnapishtim is precisely the answer to Gilgamesh's unbalanced solar nature. We may say that in the land of Utnapishtim, Gilgamesh will have to learn to leave behind his heroic approach, to learn instead the way of the prophets, the way of receptivity. This is clearly the poet's message through Utnapishtim's answer to Gilgamesh's question, how had Utnapishtim come to be in the assembly of the gods? Utnapishtim's answer to this question, that we may regard equivalent to an asking for the secret of immortality, is appropriately prefaced with his telling Gilgamesh that he will uncover for him a secret of the gods. There was an uproar in the city of Shurupak, set on the bank of the Euphrates. And he, Utnapishtim, had been silent, so that his ear had been open enough to hear the voice of air, the friendly god's wind. To the wall reed hut, man of Shurupak, son of Ubaratutu, air had then said to him, tear down the house, build an ark, abandon riches, seek life. He would build a boat according to precise measures, and like the abyss itself, it would be covered with a roof. Into his ark he commanded him to load the seed of every living thing. It had been trickery on the part of Ea to divulge, without divulging it, the secret of the gods. He only whispered to the wall, or so he pretended. Now he advises our primordial Noah to be a trickster himself. In response to the concern of Utnapishtim that he will need to answer the city, the people, and the elders, Lord Ea responds, you may say this to them, Enlil hates me. I will go down to the abyss to live with Ea, my lord. He will make richness rain on you, the choicest birds, the rarest fish. The land will have its fill of harvest riches. At dawn bread he will pour down on you, showers of wheat. When the deluge came, Ishtar cried out like a woman giving birth. How could I speak evil in the assembly of the gods? How could I cry out for battle, for the destruction of my people? I myself gave birth to my people. 6 days and 7 nights the wind shrieked, the storm flood rolled through the land, and at last the ark stood grounded on the mountain Nisir. Utnapishtim first sent out a dove, then a swallow, and both returned. Then he sent out a crow. It did not come back. Now he sacrificed, and the lady of the gods came down and said, gods, let me not forget this, by the power of the lapis lazuli on my neck. And he invited the gods to approach the offering, except Enlil, for without discussion in the assembly of the gods, he had brought on the flood. Enlil was furious that life breath had escaped the devastation. Then Ea rebuked the warrior god Enlil for sending the flood, in a frame of mind comparable to that of Abraham when he interceded for the just that might live in Sodom and Gomorrah. He said to him, punish the one who commits the crime, punish the evildoer alone. I did not unhide the secret of the great gods, Ea explained to Enlil. Utnapishtim, the overwise, a vision was shown to him. he heard the secret of the gods. And we may assume that it is in Utnapishtim's silent and obedient ear that there lies the greatest of divine secrets. Think about Ea's words now, Gilgamesh. Utnapishtim advises our hero. As he is about to finish answering his question as to how he came to be in the assembly of the gods. And he proceeds, Enlil came up to the ark, he seized my hand and picked me up, and he raised my wife up, making her kneel at my side. He touched our foreheads, and standing between us, he blessed us. Thus, not because of a superheroic effort, but because he had been silent, calm, and receptive, Utnapishtim and his wife had been transformed, becoming godlike. Not the active way of Shamash, but the passive one of the moon had brought him to the condition of living far off at the source of all rivers. That is, in a different dimension, transcendent to that of our earthly experience. Now the story proceeds to suggest that it is not courage that Gilgamesh is lacking, but subtle attention. Not the power of arms, but a power such as is necessary to not fall asleep for 6 days and 7 nights. Gilgamesh, of course, fails this test, and he even ignores or denies that he has fallen asleep. Gilgamesh cannot understand the secret of the gods, and has failed the test of wakefulness. Yet we are left with the impression that his failure is only a stage along the way. For when Ushanabi, enjoined by Utnapishtim, puts on him the robe of life, so that he may go back to his city, we have the sense that Gilgamesh's journey to death has come to an end. Let him put on an elder's robe, says Utnapishtim, and let it be always new. Ushanabi took charge of him and brought him to the washing place. He cleaned his filthy body, hair, and the water, made him pure. He cast off the skins and carried them to the sea. The goodness of his body shone out. We will find echoes of this scene in Dante's Garden of Eden, and at the beginning of Second Faust, when comparable imagery is deliberately intended to convey a rebirth. It definitely conveys renewal, purification, rejuvenation, and re-entry into a world that has been abandoned at the beginning of the long pilgrimage. One more adventure will Gilgamesh still have on his way of return to his city, to the world, and to kingship. It is an adventure in which we may see a reiterated summing up of his adventures thus far. For another secret of the gods, Utnapishtim reveals to Gilgamesh, upon his wife's prompting, as he embarks on his return journey. There is a plant at the bottom of the sea, the spike of which pricks our hand like a bramble. If you get your hands on that plant, he tells him, you'll have everlasting life. Binding heavy stones to his feet, Gilgamesh was dragged down into the abyss, where he saw the plant. He seized it. It cut into his hand, and he cast it up onto the shore. This plant of rejuvenation he would eat and give to the elders to eat, yet a snake, smelling the plant's fragrance, came up through the waters and carried it away. The plant was certainly transformative and rejuvenating, for the snake threw off its skin. Yet did Gilgamesh need to eat it? In the dreamlike language of the poem, it would seem that his involvement with plant and snake after receiving an elder's robe was all that needed to be, a sign. Perhaps he only wept out of a residual identification of longevity with spiritual permanence. The mention of his weeping is appropriate at this point of the story, however, for it is the time of what may be called a tragic victory in the hero's journey. We may say that the end of Gilgamesh is paradoxical. The end of the story depicts our hero's triumph through the imagery of failure. We cannot deny that the story is about a successful journey, for the end result is wisdom, and Gilgamesh was to be remembered as a man who became a god. But the story of the journey's end would not be accurately told if it did not appear to be that of a failure. For the triumph is not of this world, and the spiritual birth only visible to the earthly level of the mind as death. When I first knew the epic some 40 years ago, and for a long time after that, I did not really understand it, and did not understand why the earliest tale of a hero that we have would be the story of a failure in the quest. I did not understand, of course, that Gilgamesh is not the story of a failure, except from the perspective of an immature view of what the quest is about, or what it is that may be found at its end. Ego failure as the crowning event in the path that is inherently one of ego annihilation is, of course, spiritual success. It seems fitting that the ultimate victory of a superhero be a seeming defeat. We may see in Gilgamesh a precedent in this of Christ's, "Lord, why have you abandoned me?" at Golgotha. In the end, Gilgamesh was most humble, for he told us that he had only realized the truth of impermanence. There was wisdom in his willingness to present himself like a loser. He leaves us with the impression that his coming to the land of Utnapishtim was only a passing experience, something left behind like a plant that was snatched away by the snake before his return. From what he tells us, it seems to us he has returned empty-handed. Yet I think there is something that he is not saying, and which the author of the poem also is silent about, that his visit to the transcendent land of Utnapishtim made him a different person. Yet the poet is not altogether silent, for he speaks to us poetically, not through his words, but as in a whisper through the message of his medium, which is stone, just as it was stone things that allowed Ushanabi's boat to cross the waters of death, and stone that, tied to his feet, carried Gilgamesh down into the abyss, to the plant of life. In the end, he engraved in stone the whole story. Why stone and not clay tablets, as have come to us? Not so much for its practical advantages, I believe, but for its meaning. We may be sure that for Gilgamesh, as for our megalithic ancestors and for the Egyptian pyramid builders, stone meant permanence. Just as fire in its evanescence evokes life, the seeming changelessness of stone suggests death, death as the deathless, a permanence that is not of this world. For all is truly impermanent, and yet there is a knowledge of impermanence, a wisdom or consciousness beyond its objects that is like a deathlessness, and which, I think, Gilgamesh knew as well as every spiritual man at the end of the path. At the end of the poem, Gilgamesh celebrates the city to which he has returned, and to the building of which we may surmise he contributed. Inspect the base, view the brickwork. Is not the very core made of oven-fired brick? Did not the seven sages lay down its foundation? In Uruk, house of Ishtar, one part is city, one part orchards, and one part clay pits. Three, including the clay pits, make up Uruk. Long live the memory of Gilgamesh, who made the great crossing, who knew the abyss, who became a servant of life, and who, in accepting his humanity, became complete. So ends the epic of Gilgamesh, I think we may say, in spite of the fact that Sinlequi Unini's version contains still a 12th tablet in which is described the journey of Enkidu to the underworld. Surely the compiler must have respected an established tradition in including this fragment in the work, though it constitutes a non sequitur at the end of the poem, for Enkidu has been long ago dead. In a different position, this text could be fitting, especially after the passage when Enkidu dreamt about being carried by a vulture-like being to the House of Ashes. Inserted before Tablet 8, the descent of Enkidu into hell would precede Gilgamesh's lament and complete the account of his passing away. Something that perhaps has contributed to its being left to the end, however, is the reinforcement that it provides at this point to a meaning that is only implicit in the epic, the affirmation of life. Whether you read it at the end or before the setting out of Gilgamesh in search of Utnapishtim, the essential content of the descent of Enkidu into hell is news to the effect that the realm of shadows is not so good as that of the living. Father Ea had a hole be made to the underworld so that the ghost of Enkidu might rise from the darkness and tell the ways of the underworld to his brother. During his fleeting return, Enkidu was able to tell Gilgamesh, "I will not tell you, friend, I will not tell you, if I must tell you the ways of the underworld that I have seen, sit down and weep." I think that after his return, Gilgamesh allowed the advice that Siduri, according to the Sumerian version, had given him in the Garden of the Sun. "As for you, Gilgamesh, let your belly be full. Make merry day and night. Of each day make a feast of rejoicing. Day and night dance and play. Let your garments be sparkling fresh, your head be washed, bathed in water. Pay heed to a little one that holds on you your hand. Let a spouse delight you in your bosom, for this is the task of woman." Gilgamesh had rejected this advice, as he had rejected his old garment in the savage pilgrimage to the beyond. So I think we can give him credit for having found that the other shore is no different from the one he had set out from in the first place. In a veiled manner, the Gilgamesh poem addresses the paradoxical fact that the journey does not need to be made, and yet nobody can know this without making it. And I want to end with a quotation from E.J. Gold. Many attain liberation just by realizing how impossible it is.